Now, the Mexican filmmaker Guillermo del Toro's best known as the master of magical fantasy, with movies like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy under his belt. And since childhood, he's been obsessed with vampires. Now, he's decided to try his hand at fiction writing with a new vampire novel called The Strain. He co-wrote it with Chuck Hogan, a veteran thriller writer. Guillermo del Toro joins us from Burbank, California. Welcome.
Hey, how are you? Pleasure to be here.
I want to describe the opening of this book, The Strain. Basically, a jumbo jet lands at JFK Airport, and almost everyone on board is dead. And it's really where this story of a mysterious and alarming outbreak begins. It almost sounds in that first scene like it's a deliberate reference to Bram Stoker's Dracula, which opens with a mysterious, crewless ship that washes ashore.
Yeah, that is correct. In the novel of Dracula, at one point, the ship Demeter stops at Whitby, and it docks with almost everybody dead and the coffin inside of the cargo area. And it was a deliberate quote on that, in the same way that is a deliberate quote to call one of the main characters Abraham Cetrakian, in honor of Abraham Van Helsing.
Mm.
But the idea was also to create almost like a thriller, a medical thriller, combining medieval fears with cutting-edge science and pandemics and all these horrors that we consider sophisticated but are, in my mind, still medieval horrors that are boogeymen that scare us.
The premise of this book is essentially that vampires have always been with us, but sort of now they're seizing the moment. They're about to take advantage of this opportunity, and they're going to start in Manhattan. Why did you set it in New York?
You know, it is the city that belongs. It's almost like the metropolis of all tales. You know, it takes the imagination of the entire world. And I also wanted to set it up against a background that is powerful, because the vampires in the novels, it's three of them that we're writing, they nest in places of great tragedy. I don't want to spoil anymore for anyone that hasn't read it, but,
right.
You know, they are followed, they are tracked through history in places of enormous pain. And there is a very significant portion that takes place in the hollowed out areas beneath World Trade Center.
Now, vampire stories seem to have this kind of universal and endless appeal. And so many writers and movie makers have been able to come up with different scenarios for them. I mean, most recently, you know, sort of seeing vampires hanging out at shopping malls or going to the opera in tuxedos. But your vampires are real villains. I mean, they are really evil.
Well, they are actually just a parasitic, really brutal form of another living creature. And the killings and the drainings, so to speak, are not this warm feeling, like a almost orgasmic Barbara Cartland gothic romance beautiful moment. It is, you know, you turn into a Capri Sun container and these things are sucking you dry, and they are absolutely this feeling of being vacuumed out of your life force is described as in brutal detail as we can.
Did you do that because, in a sense, you feel as if vampires have been portrayed as these kinds of kitschy and almost friendly caricatures of what they ought to be?
Well, I've been a very strange kid, and from the age 7 on, I've been 37 years, I've been deliberately putting together as minute a notebook about vampire biology and about vampire anatomy, and always thinking that the vampires that I was fascinated as a reader by were these monsters. They were not these romantic, decadent, existential bad boys.
We're speaking with filmmaker Guillermo del Toro about his new novel, The Strain. Mr. del Toro, a few weeks ago we interviewed another Mexican filmmaker, Carlos Cuarón, who of course you know very well.
Yes.
I want to put a question to you that I put to Carlos Cuarón, which is about the quality of your filmmaking and now your fiction writing. Is there something distinctively Mexican about what you do and what you produce, even though most of your work no longer takes place in Mexico?
Yes, absolutely. I think the opposite is what is hard to imagine. I come from where I come from, and my culture allows me to sort of believe and accept the supernatural in a readily way. I accept the monsters and the creatures and the fact that they exist in a completely more natural way than I would say an Anglo-Saxon narrator or a storyteller would.
one of the big differences between a novel and a movie, of course, is that in a novel, the reader sort of has to take a leap of imagination and picture in his or her mind's eye what's going on. And yet, it seems you can't quite stay away from the movie side here. There are actually some mini films circulating on the internet to promote the book, and they've gone viral on YouTube. Let's hear a bit of one of them.
What you fought was a dead man possessed by a disease.
Well, like a zombie?
Well, think more along the lines of a man with a black cape, fangs, a funny accent. I'll take away the cape, the fangs, and a funny accent. In fact, take away anything funny about it.
I think people who are fans of your work, like Pan's Labyrinth and Hellboy, are going to be asking the question, when are you going to make this into a Del Toro film?
I don't think I will. I really think we intended it as a long-form narrative, and maybe down the line we can try and adapt it into a graphic novel or cable series or something like that, but I would not try to compress them to a single film or something like that.
Now, I've seen photos of the inside of your home in Los Angeles, and I was wondering if you could describe what a visitor to your home in L.A. might encounter.
Well, about a year and a half, I bought myself a second house separate from the family house that I called Bleak House. And in Bleak House, I lodge all my libraries because I've been collecting books since I was 4 years old. I don't have my first book, but I have my second book on, and it's six libraries. One dedicated to horror, one dedicated to art and sculpture, painting, and so forth. Another one dedicated only to fairy tales and folklore, film, comic books, blah, blah, blah. And all of this is side by side with movie props from my movies, other people's movies, a statuary, fantastic statuary, about 350 pages of original art from comic books, children's fantasy illustration. It's essentially the man cave that a kid would have if he was financially okay.
And how much time do you spend there?
A lot. I wake up, I take the girls to school, and then I go and work in Bleak House all day, just reading, drawing, writing. I have a secret bookshelf passage that you open, and it leads you into a haunted mansion room. And it's a fantasy place.
Will you give us a tour next time we're in L.A.?
Oh, absolutely. I would love to.
We're looking forward to that. That's film director and novelist Guillermo del Toro. His first novel, co-written with Chuck Hogan, is called The Strain. Mr. Del Toro, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Good night.
As you often hear on this program, the U.S. auto industry is in deep, deep trouble. But there's at least one place in America where cars still reign supreme, the lowrider culture in Southern California. Reporter Corey Takahashi went to the Lowrider 2009 tour to talk to people who love gas-guzzling, big-body cars they can cruise low and slow.
The American car is still king at this show in San Bernardino. That's a GM Classic, a 1963 Chevy Impala hopping up and down on hydraulic lifts. At this show, there will always be just one kind of GM, the GM that existed before the oil crisis of the 1970s, the GM that built hulking family cars that rebellious kids turned into lowriders.
Put it this way, GM hasn't designed a car that the lowrider automotive culture would accept for the last, 30 years.
Joe Ray is the editor of Lowrider magazine. It's the host of this tour and car competition. Ray's eyes wander to the bold wings on a 1959 Chevy Impala.
That's incredible, man. And you see those, they're so rare, but you're always going to find them at lowrider shows. A 50-year-old car right there.
The Chevy Impala was basically a family vehicle in its early years. Models from the 1950s and 1960s defined the lowrider style. But people at this show say models from more recent years look like Toyota Camrys. Rapper Cynic agrees.
Anything old school, I'm in it.
Cynic says American automakers took a wrong turn.
I think it got cheaper and cheaper as time went on, more time efficient, put together type. Because all the cars are basically made out of fiberglass plastic, you know. Back in the days, everything was metal, you know. It took art form to make an automobile.
It's easy to see Trino Alfaro's award-winning Impala, Cherry 64, as a work of art. Cherry glistens on a rotating display with mirrors underneath it. The car sparkles with engraved chrome and intricate murals. Alfaro says GM's bankruptcy is likely to boost the market for cars like his.
I think these cars are going to be worth more because it's probably going to be because they're GM, because they're going to be worth more money.
This show is a kind of living museum. There are plenty of Chevy El Caminos here too, even though GM stopped making them in the 1980s. Alfred Big Al Carr inherited an El Camino from his father, and Carr won the show's hydraulic hopping contest in his souped-up heirloom.
Maybe GM will see this and want to continue the El Camino.
Do you really think that might happen?
No, I don't. But it's worth a try.
Lowriders say their hard work has always been aimed at bringing new life to cars that seem unsalvageable. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.